Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dale, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour, and I apologise for the state of my voice. I'm a little bit under the weather. As many of our investors and listeners would be aware, share markets have experienced some long-awaited volatility in recent weeks, with both the US and local share markets entering a technical correction, although back up again 3% last week. So many investors are wondering whether now is the time to head for the hills or to start picking up bargains before prices start marching higher again. Today, to help us understand what has been happening and what the future could hold, I'm joined by Roger Montgomery, CIO and founder of Montgomery Investment Management, one of the market and NABTrade's favourite market experts. I should add, Roger has published a fantastic book, Valuable, which will be available at the ASX Investor Day. That will be this weekend in Sydney and in the following weeks in Brisbane and Melbourne. So if you'd like to get a copy of the book, come and see us at the NABTrade stand. Roger, thanks so much for joining me.
A pleasure, Gemma.
So Roger, can you quickly run us through where we are from a market cycle perspective and how we find ourselves here?
Well, we've had 37 years of declining interest rates down to 2016. So since 1980 through to the middle or late 2016, we saw rates fall precipitously. That has been a tailwind at the back of baby boomers since they were in their 30s. Remember, baby boomers hit their 30s in the 1980s. So that's when they started earning serious money, and asset prices have gone up ever since. So many of them think that they're genius investors, when in actual fact, they've just had this great tailwind. But that is all changing now. And in fact, in more recent times, we've seen a capitulation in interest rates. They fell more steeply after the financial crisis, and we saw ZIRP policy in the United States, which is zero interest rate policy, and NERP in Europe, which is negative interest rate policy. At the same time, we saw abundant amounts of money flow into the banking system, the financial system, and to the economy. Consequently, what's happened over recent years is a boom in pretty much every asset class. So globally, property boomed, whether it was Hong Kong or Toronto or New York, it all went up. We saw record prices achieved in fine art, record prices achieved in fine wine, record prices achieved in collectible cars. The highest price ever paid for a British car was $22.5 million last year for a racing Aston Martin. The highest price ever paid for any vehicle at all was $63 million this year for a Ferrari. We've seen record prices paid for New Zealand stamps. The highest price ever paid for a New Zealand stamp was earlier this year. We've seen record prices for everything. You name it, it's hit a record. Now, this is a function of the fact that cash was a liability. When interest rates become or head so low that they become punitive in terms of their returns, people want anything but. One of the things you saw was people funneling into, or very wealthy people funneling into, private equity and funding loss-making startups. That only exists when interest rates are so low that people don't want the money in the bank. And consequently, we've seen a proliferation of new technology right across the spectrum, you know, whether it's 3D printing or digital advertising, electric cars, autonomous vehicles, AI, you name it. All of this boom has again been a function of low interest rates. That's all changing now. Interest rates are now going up, they're not going down. And the US Federal Reserve needs to raise rates reasonably promptly, because if you go back and look over all the past recessions in the United States, you find that the Federal Reserve cut rates by an average of 400 basis points, now, or 4%. They don't have rates at 4%, so they need to get rates up there in order to be able to cut again for the next recession, if and when it occurs, and it probably will. So that's where we find ourselves at the moment. Asset prices at record highs, but the backdrop fundamentally shifting. And so when you've got record prices, record multiples of earnings, and really silly things. In Australia, for example, a portfolio of companies, there was a portfolio I put together, just a hypothetical one, that had A2 Milk, Afterpay, Xero, Appen, and Altium. And
all the A's.
All the A's. and all of those companies combined, WiseTech was another one. All of those companies combined had a market cap of, this is just in early September, late August, early September, They had a market capitalisation of about $30 billion, total revenue of two, and total profit of $245 million. And of that, A2 Milks was 131. So the remaining companies were on 490 times earnings collectively. So that kind of stuff is a function of low interest rates. That's what we call a blow-off top in our experience. And the market is now starting to adjust to the idea that the background, the narrative is changing. Interest rates are going up, money's being pulled out of the system, and if you invest at very high prices, you're going to get a very low return.
That's an incredibly powerful statement of the context we find ourselves in. I was going to make the comment, you're a value investor, you have been very clear about your thoughts on valuations. That 490 times earnings could not be more articulate as a representation of how much people are willing to pay for the potential of growth. Not even growth, but the potential of growth.
The hope.
Yeah, the hope.
It really is the hope.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about valuations? There's been a sell-off in the US. We saw a sell-off here too, but then things have bounced back. So what are your thoughts as things start to look like they're changing?
Well, day to day and week to week, it really makes no difference. It's impossible to pick movements over such a short period of time. But what we know is there's a basic aphorism that everyone should remember, and that is the one that I ended the last statement with, and that was, the higher the price you pay, the lower your return. Yeah. It really is that simple. So you have to look on a ground-up basis at each individual company. So we've seen lots of companies fall. So since I wrote an article for The Australian about that portfolio of stocks that I mentioned earlier, they've subsequently fallen up to 50%. In fact, some of them have fallen by more than 50% now. So the question is there good value there? Well, now you go back to trying to understand whether or not the companies can deliver on the promises that were imposed on them by a euphoric market. And I think in many cases, many of these companies won't exist. They exist only because people were willing to give them a go, but many of them, investors will find that their mechanics in a slowing economy or a rising interest rate environment or both, their economics will be very, very ugly. Consumer finance business like Afterpay, for example, will experience the same credit environment that all other credit providers experience. There's nothing special about them that's going to make them immune. I think we'll see lower returns even after the sell-off. So there's probably more to come. There's probably more weakness for the companies over the next 12 months. That's not to say that they can't rally into Christmas or, you know, that we'll see higher prices, but I would be thinking very, very carefully about selling any riskier, dodgier companies that I had, and we don't have any, but if I had them in my portfolio, I'd be using any strength that exists between now and Christmas or early in the new year to reduce my holdings in those companies. Because again, the fundamental backdrop is changing and it's deteriorating.
Anything you want to call out there as one you would be perhaps trimming or getting rid of?
Look, we don't own it, but you know, I wouldn't want to own things like Kogan. I wouldn't want to own a company like Afterpay or PushPay. They have done well because the economy has done very well and people are employed and everyone's reasonably content. But in an environment where the economy slows, and why do I think the economy is going to slow? I think it's going to slow because one of the major drivers of the economy is consumption. Longer term, I think we're going to see an aging of the global population. In fact, the countries responsible for 70% of global growth will see the proportion of people over the age of 64 almost double over the next 35 years. Now, when people get older, they spend less. They might spend more on travel, but they don't buy as many clothes. You know, they just spend less. You ask your mum or your dad what they want for Christmas or their birthday, and they say, nothing. I just want you guys to be happy. I just want you to get along with your brother. You know, that's all they say. So people spend less. So that's a long-term reason for expecting there to be some pressure on consumption as a driver of growth. And shorter term, we're seeing a downturn in the construction industry in Australia. The construction industry is the third largest employer in the country. The second largest employer is retail, and the third largest is healthcare. So what we've got now is we've got a declining construction sector. That means tradies and particularly chippies and plumbers and sparkies, they won't be earning as much money as they were earning in the past. So they will, if they're sensible, be spending less. And remember, many of them have a mortgage. Many of them have an interest-only mortgage. And those interest-only, a lot of those interest-only mortgages are going to be moved on to principal and interest in 2019 and 2020. In fact, back in 2015, $159 billion of interest-only loans were written. And that was about 49% of all loans written. Now, the banks are capped at 30% of all loans written being interest only. So that means 19% of all the loans written in 2015 will be migrated onto principal and interest. And the repayments can be, will be an the increase in repayments will be an average of about 40%. Some people will see their repayments go up by 60 or 70%. And that'll put more pressure on people who've got less work in the construction industry. So I think we're going to see really tough times for the consumption or the retail sector, and that's going to slow our economy down. So that's why I think that we're going to have some pressure on prices going forward.
So it's a bit of a segue on your point about the transition to interest-only loans. The statistic I think I've never quite gotten over, and I heard it in the back of a taxi on my way to the airport, was that at one point Westpac had 50% of its entire loan book in interest-only loans.
Right, and what's really scary is UBS conducted a survey, the Swiss Investment Bank surveyed 3,000 or 4,000 interest-only mortgage holders in Australia, and 14% of them didn't know they had an interest-only mortgage. And another equally significant percentage borrowed and chose to borrow interest-only for the tax deductibility, but they'd bought their own home. There's no tax deductibility.
Oh, wow.
So a large proportion of people who've borrowed money in recent years don't know the product that they've got.
Fully unaware.
That they don't understand the consequences. So I think we're going to see lower real estate prices. That's going to have a negative wealth effect. We're going to see less work on for the construction industry in the residential construction sector. And that's going to mean less income. And consequently, you know, Mirvac's an example of that. Mirvac came out during the full year reporting season. Last year they sold 3,277 residential lots. And this year they're forecasting 2,500 residential lot sales. So there's a lot less work on. And that just means less income, tighter credit, higher interest rates, tougher repayment terms, and things are just going to slow down a bit. And that's why you're not seeing the Reserve Bank of Australia raise rates.
So the very next question I was going to ask you was that the RBA has been really clear. So in the US, you were pointing out that the Fed has to raise rates. Mm. You cannot keep rates at record lows indefinitely, and certainly not with a very fast growing economy in the US.
Correct.
Real risk that Trump's policies will run head on into the Fed's policies and someone's going to break. In Australia, it's clear that the trajectory is upward, but not for quite some time. And you've pointed out about low rates underpinning valuations for everything. No, I was going to say equities, but everything. Mm. Clearly, they've underpinned property prices. Now, property prices are coming off pretty dramatically because of the availability of credit and a few other things.
And interest rates are going up.
So do you think that that lack
Not
of
at the NAB, of course.
We won't talk about what the NAB's up to.
The NAB's not raising rates, but everyone else has.
For now, notice we did not put an end date on that.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're very clear here. I mean, everyone understands at some point rates will have to go up because banks do heaps of their borrowing offshore.
Correct.
It's not all coming from onshore, and therefore you are subject to the same pressures as everybody else. But it's not happening immediately. Do you think that people will continue to invest in equities because the other asset classes look awful? Or do you think they'll start retreating to cash or trying to find something else entirely?
I can't
Although
predict
obviously
what other
wine
people...
and cars aren't going to do the job.
Yeah, wine and cars and collectibles and art, and they don't produce any income. Really, the value in those is imposed on them by the next buyer or seller. So, you know, there's no income, there's no way to value those things. You really have to just predict other people's willingness to pay. And presumably when interest rates go up and money's less abundant, their willingness to pay high prices will disappear. Yeah, it's very, very difficult to predict how people are going to respond. But owning businesses over the long run is the best place to be. If you look at the AFR Rich 200, you know, no one in there is rich because they put money in the bank in cash. You know, they owned a business. They focused on that business and they ran it very well, and it's a successful business. But your best chance of making money over 8, 10, 15, 20 year time frame is owning outstanding businesses. But, you know, caveat that with outstanding. They have to be extraordinary businesses. They can't be mediocre businesses. Time is the friend of a wonderful business. It's the enemy of a mediocre business. You could be invested for 10 or 15 years in the top 10 stocks in Australia, and because most of their earnings are paid out as a dividend and they don't retain much for growth, they don't grow much, and guess what? Their share price hasn't done very much.
Yeah, we have some interesting data on that I'm going to talk about in a week or two.
Okay.
Some very interesting data on that. On your point about outstanding businesses, so I was recently interviewed by Hugh Remington from Channel 10.
Yes.
And he's a very well-regarded journalist. He's been around a really long time. He's
intelligent guy.
Very intelligent guy. And he made the comment, because we were talking about markets and stocks and how you should respond to the current market, that he had only ever owned two direct shares in his life. And they were both inherited, for want of a better word. One was AMP as a result of the demutualization,
yep.
And one was Channel 10. Now, it knocked my socks off, honestly, as a conversation with an intelligent person, that was the experience he'd had with direct equities. They'd both been so horrific, to be frank. One, he'd lost everything on those, and the other, he's lost a very substantial amount of money. So people do have to face into the possibility that what you consider to be a blue chip may be worth nothing in 10 years' time, and the quality of the business that you're investing in has to be robust now, and it has to be sort of forward-looking.
So there's a couple of things to look for to help sort the wheat from the chaff. It's pretty straightforward. If you don't mind me saying, I wrote about this in my book. There's a chapter on return on equity in my book. And so what we look for are very high rates of return on incremental capital, or very high rates of return on equity. Why is that important? Because think about it this way. Most people are focused on the profits they can get out of a business or the dividends that they can get out of a business. But a business owner is concentrating on how much they need to put in order to get that money out. So if I offered you the opportunity to buy two businesses, both earning $1 million, would you prefer the one that you had to invest $2 million in to get the million out, or one that you had to invest $20 million to get the million out? Clearly, you're interested in the one that you only have to put two in. And so that's a very high rate of return on equity. That generated a 50% return on equity, whereas the other one was only 5% return on equity. So you want, intuitively, you know that high rates of return on equity businesses are attractive. Now, if you find those businesses and they can sustain that high rate of return on equity for a long time, you'll do brilliantly. That's the CSLs of the world, the Macquaries of the world, the Reece Plumbing, ARB, REA Group, which owns the realestate.com.au website. You know, those sorts of businesses have generated high rates of return on equity for a very long period of time. So then you ask yourself the question, well, have they been able to do that? Because if they're generating really attractive returns that everyone wants, why doesn't another business start up in that space and compete against them? Well, they do, but they're able to fend them off. They've got some competitive advantage that prevents other people from being as successful as them. So in the case of realestate.com.au, the REA Group, for example, there are over 80 websites in Australia that offer you the opportunity to list your house for sale. Most of them let you do it for free. How is it that REA can earn so much money and charge the most, and people will still advertise with it? Well, it's just got, whether it's the best user interface, or it was first, or whatever it was, people want to use that website. And because more people are looking for homes on that website, more agents tell their customers to list their homes on that website. And then because there are more homes listed, more people come and have a look, and it's a virtuous circle. And so we're looking for those businesses that can generate high rates of return on equity. In order to be able to do it sustainably, they have to have a competitive advantage. The most valuable competitive advantage of all is the ability to raise prices without a detrimental impact on your unit sales volume. So ask yourself the question, look at your portfolio, look at the companies in it, and put your hand on your heart and ask, do I believe this company can generate outsized returns on its equity into the future? Therefore, does it have a competitive advantage?
So we were talking before we started about AMP. How would it fit into that category?
It doesn't fit into that category at all. In fact, I use in talks that I've given around the country in the past, I've used AMP as a case study for the sort of business we wouldn't want to buy. And unsurprisingly, its share price reflects its business performance. Benjamin Graham, who was Warren Buffett's mentor, said, "In the short run, the market is a voting machine, but in the long run, it's a weighing machine. In the long run, the price will follow the economic performance of the business. If you buy a business with great economic performance, yes, day to day, week to week, even year to year, the price will be volatile. But in the long run, the price can't help but track the performance of the business. Buy an average business or a mediocre business, share price will reflect it."
It's important because I think a lot of people, when they hear value investing, they think buy cheap, right? They can summarize it into two words.
Yeah, so that's deep value investing. That's different to what we do.
And value obviously requires that there be some value in what you're buying cheap.
Indeed.
It needs to be cheap relative to what it's going to offer you in the long run rather than cheap as to relative to what it was 6 weeks ago.
And there's lots of different ways of approaching that question about what's cheap and what's... And we use an intrinsic value formula, and in my book I offer a formula for calculating intrinsic value. But it's not that complicated. You know, you take CSL, for example. CSL recently traded as high as $225 a share. Now, that put it on a market capitalization of about $107 billion. To put that in context, if you take CSL's core business and assume that it was never going to grow again, it wasn't going to be able to grow into new markets, and it wasn't going to be able to raise prices, then it earns $3 billion. If you want an 8% return from that bond, let's assume it became a bond, it didn't grow at all, it just paid out a coupon of 8% every year. Well, at 8%, $3 billion, you're willing to pay $37.5 billion for that business. But its market cap was 107. In other words, people were willing to buy three current CSLs for the growth of one. And that just to us seems preposterous. And I gave the example earlier with Altium and Appen and A2 Milk and WiseTech and so forth. They were on a market, a PE of 490 times earnings. Whichever way you look at it, they're all expensive. Mm. And so when you're thinking about value, you just need to be rational. You just need to approach value with a rational view. We find that the intrinsic value approach is really useful because it acts like picture a lighthouse on a rocky outcrop with a tempest raging around it. You can see what the market is for what it is. If it's cheap, you can see that because you've got value in mind or the valuation in mind. And when it's frighteningly expensive, you can see that too because the valuation is a lot lower than the current prices. So we just zip up our wallet when it's super expensive, and we get really interested when markets are falling like they are now.
So you're starting to get interested in some stuff. I'll ask you two questions here. One is markets in the US have come off somewhat.
Yes.
But off very, very high valuations. You do run money in international markets as well.
Yeah, we do.
So your thoughts on valuations coming back a little bit in the US in particular?
The majority of stocks are still overpriced. They're trading above our estimate of their value. But that doesn't mean there isn't a tail of companies that are cheap. And so you've always got to be on the lookout for those companies. See, people often, I think most of our listeners would perhaps unwittingly use price as their cue for what's cheap or what's quality. Really, you can't use price as your cue. You know, you can't be influenced by the market's ups and downs. That's a little bit like betting on black or red at the casino, you know, betting on up and down. Put that aside, don't worry about that. Work out what a company is worth, and then if the price falls below that amount, then it's interesting. If it's not below that amount, then you just come back another day. And the great thing about the stock market, it doesn't mind if you ignore it. It'll be back tomorrow with new prices.
Yeah, yeah, plenty of people happy to put something out there for you. Mm.
Yeah.
So in Australia, your thoughts on where we are and what opportunities are being thrown up?
At the moment, there's not a great deal of value, even after the recent declines. Mm. The banks are interesting. I think their outlook will continue to deteriorate. And I think analysts will bring down their expectations. And so there'll be some derating of earnings next year and the year after. But to a large degree, maybe not completely, but to a large degree, the prices have reflected that. So they're already showing some value. Now, that doesn't mean the prices can't fall further, but if they do, they're even cheaper. So we have about 9% of our domestic portfolios in the Aussie banks, and only in two of them. And NAB is one of them. But they represent 27% of the market index, the four banks. So we could own a lot more of them.
32% of NAB Trade investor portfolios.
Right, there you go. So
our investors
very
would be
high.
Three times.
Yeah, so we're underweight the banks, and if their prices fall further, well, we see that as something to be excited about. You know, we approach the markets the same way you might approach knowing you're going to buy a house or a car or going on a holiday or a boat in a couple of years' time. If I said to you, Gemma, you know, you're looking at buying a car. Do you want that car in 2 years' time? Do you want that car to be more expensive or cheaper? You know, you would say, I'd like the price of that car to go down. Mm. Well, we approach the stock market the same way. We're net buyers, and so we want to buy at a cheaper price. So our hope is prices fall.
Right. Mm. So at this point, any further tips for investors?
I think now is the time to be patient. If you've got assets that are highly geared and you're showing a profit, then seek advice about whether or not it's essential in your portfolio. I would be careful about having any assets that are highly geared because you don't want to be in a situation where you're forced to sell at a lower price and then you've got negative equity, for example. And that's true of houses or anything else. I think in the next 2 years, there will be plenty of opportunities to buy things at prices you never thought you would see again. And prices for many assets will be back there. And I'm looking forward to that.
That sounds really exciting. Roger, you and your team produce some exceptional content and a lot of it, really high quality stuff. People love to get it. Many NAB Trade investors find your content via our platform. But where else would people go to see what you guys are doing?
Oh, thank you
there?
For inviting me to offer that. RogerMontgomery.com. And so if you're interested, we post two blogs a day at RogerMontgomery.com. And you can also buy the book Valuable through that site. So you just click on the tab that says book and you can buy the book there too.
Roger Montgomery of Montgomery Investment Management, thank you so much for joining me.
A pleasure, Gemma.
As always, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it has been helpful for you in your journey to creating wealth. We always love to hear from you. So if you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.